Hi, Nathan.
Hey, Bob.
What do you mean we haven't talked in a while? That was funny. Happy anniversary-ish, maybe, almost. I don't know.
This is the anniversary of the podcast.
It is. Not necessarily the anniversary of when the first episode was uploaded, but the anniversary of when we first began this journey, this epic quest to get you to watch a whole ton of shit that you should have seen years ago and for various reasons did not. And it has been going swimmingly.
Yeah, a full year of it.
Yeah, full year. We've covered a lot of ground, a lot of movies, a lot of TV. You finally accomplished your goal of getting me to watch all of Lost.
And
I'm not saying that it's the greatest show ever made. It's not happening. The fuck was that?
Don't worry about it.
Okay.
God.
All right. I mean,
turn your fucking phone off.
Turn your fucking phone off. So,
Lost and
Dexter.
No, Lost and
Found.
Year One.
We never even talked about Year One on this.
It's a shame.
Year One predates this podcast.
It's the only thing we should be talking about.
It should be. It's, yeah.
Does it predate?
I'm pretty sure. Yeah, I think it does.
Do you want to tell them the story? Do you want to tell the story?
The story of you saying, hey.
Showing you
one of the best movies. Yeah, the story of you being like, hey, why don't I pick one this time? Something you've never seen. I said, okay. And I said, what are we going to watch? You said, I'm going to show you Year One. It's really funny. And I said, okay.
It is really funny.
I'm like, the one with Jack Black and what's his nuts from Arrested Development? You're like, yes.
Yeah.
And then we watched it.
Yeah, we did.
We sure did.
What did you do?
I watched it?
No. You made fun of it.
You
made fun of the entire duration of the goddamn movie. You picked it apart like it was fucking Taxi Driver or something. It's just a fun movie, a fun, stupid movie
is
with Jack Black and Michael. Yes, it is. It's so funny.
Hey, rewatch.
No, you don't deserve a rewatch.
See, I see. So this anniversary GD that we're doing, general discussion, was just an excuse for you to give me shit about my opinion of Year One.
That's all it's going to be about.
Year One from a year ago.
This is a sting operation.
I do remember liking that one line. I can't remember what it is.
One line.
You remember, though.
There's millions of lines.
No, the one towards the beginning where what the hell was it? The one where he was like tasting the piece of shit or something? Or that, yeah. No. Not even that. What was it? Michael Cera saying something where like he picked a whole bunch of like berries or something. And
yeah.
Then, I don't know. Something.
Well, hi, Marlac.
Like, he's like, oh, yeah, well, I guess we were going to do that for the pie, but you know, that's fine. Okay, whatever.
Yeah, well, now we all lose.
Yeah, I guess no pie for any of us. All right, that's fine.
You remember more of it than I thought.
You know, Michael Cera doing Michael Cera.
Michael Cera, yeah, okay.
Which I think is the joke, is that it's cavemen, but it's literally Michael Cera and Jack Black being Michael Cera and Jack Black
as
cavemen.
Yeah, the fact that Michael Cera's a gatherer.
Yes.
This is so funny.
In a movie directed by Harold Ramis just before he died, I think that was the joke I made at the time. I'm like, oh, this is what killed Harold Ramis.
Yes.
Directing this movie.
Yeah.
For those that don't
you
know.
You did say that many times.
Harold Ramis, for those that aren't in the know, was both a writer, director, and actor. He directed the original National Lampoon's Vacation. He directed Groundhog Day. He directed Year One. But he also acted in several films. Most notably, he paired up with Bill Murray for Stripes. And then a couple of years after that, they paired up again in Ghostbusters and Ghostbusters 2. Harold Ramis played Egon Spengler, the nerdier of the Ghostbusters, the one with the glasses, who has since passed on. So
damn.
Yeah, so that was a time when we watched that. That was
it's okay, I'm over it.
Obviously. Yeah, there's no bitterness involved at all. Hey, you know what? Credit where credit is due. Let's even things out. My reaction to that movie is retaliation for you falling asleep during at least two out of the four Indiana Jones movies right before the end of each movie.
It was three of them.
Was it three out of the four? Good, good. And you know what? I bet the only one that you stayed awake for the whole thing of was probably Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
Is that the one with Shia LaBeoufla?
Yep.
Yep.
Is that the one you stayed awake for?
I remember that one the most. Unfortunately.
Good God. Hey, you know what? The new one comes out in, I think, May or June.
Really?
So we're due for a rewatch because we didn't watch those for the podcast. And obviously you barely remember them, so it'll be like watching them again for the first time. And we can watch them in 4K.
Did we not watch them in 4K to begin with?
No, because it wasn't out yet at the time.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
I like the second one a lot.
Yeah, Temple of Doom.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Is that the World War? Well, they're not really World War II.
No, they didn't do World War II. All those movies take place after World War I. It has Nazis, but it doesn't take place when America had joined the war yet.
Oh, okay.
Because they're all like 1936, 1935, somewhere around there.
Wow. Well, Bob, you sure do know a lot about Nazi history. What aren't you telling? That's strange. Kidding.
It is kind of ironic when you think about it that, like, two out of the three movies... I keep saying three as if there's not a fourth one. Some people would hope that there weren't.
Honestly, I was a little confused when he said, you fell asleep through all four. I was like, four?
Four?
There's three.
Okay, so fine. I find it kind of ironic that two out of the three original movies featured Nazis as the prominent villains in movies directed by Steven Spielberg, who would then, a couple of years later, go on to make Schindler's List, where it's like, oh, it's not amusing. It's not in any way, shape, or form something to, you know, make light of, and yet he totally did for two movies. But, you know, you need villains. And it's a timely picture. And it makes sense in the context of the movie why they're the villains. But, like, obviously the real atrocities of the Nazis are not what is focused upon in Indiana Jones. No. So,
I like the second one.
You like the one that people like the least of the original three.
Really?
Yeah.
Why?
A lot of people... So a lot of the elements that were in the first movie, Raiders of the Lost Ark, that they did bring back for Last Crusade,
yeah,
are not in Temple of Doom. So, like, you don't get any of the stuff with him as the teacher at the university. You don't get his friend Marcus Brody, who works at the school. You don't see him at all. Gimli from Lord of the Rings playing Sala, the digger from Egypt, he doesn't show up in Temple of Doom. A lot of the stuff that was in... They don't repeat the same girlfriend because Marion's not in the second one. So a lot of the elements that are in Raiders of the Lost Ark as the first movie are not in Temple of Doom. And I think the reason a lot of those things show up again in Last Crusade is because of the negative reaction to Temple of Doom. So they're like, all right, let's go a little bit more back towards what worked in the first one.
You don't need that.
I've grown to like it more over the years. The one thing that I think people need to keep in mind when watching that is that even though it's the second movie, and they don't blatantly say it, it is a prequel. Because I think Raiders of the Lost Ark takes place in 1935, and Temple of Doom takes place in 1934, so it's a year beforehand.
Oh, really?
And I think, like, the attitude of Indiana Jones is different in Temple of Doom.
Yeah.
So it's almost like the, not the origin, but, like, the change in his personality or his demeanor. Because he's very much, at the beginning of that movie, all about, like, you know, fortune and glory, kid. Fortune and glory. I want to get these stones. I want to get them to the museum. I want to make some money off of this.
Yeah.
He's like,
yeah.
You know, even the beginning when he's in Shanghai and he's... showing up in that white suit looking all like James Bond and shit, and he's like talking to the Asian gangsters about the he is almost like a mercenary, like a grave robber. He got the remains, the ashes or whatever of their ancient, like, whatever deity, you know, Nurhaji, and like he's literally being paid for it in gold and a diamond. So it's like, oh, he's like a mercenary. He's doing shit for profit. And then his attitude's very cold. And, you know, he's not like a completely cold-hearted bastard. But it's like, I think as that movie develops and like, he's all about getting, he's going there to the temple to potentially get the stone back for the villagers. But he doesn't believe in their, you know, spiritual bullshit.
Right.
He's like, it's the sacred Shankara stone. It's a, you know, it's a relic. It's a, it belongs in a museum. You know, it's fortune and glory, kid. And it's all about just going to the temple to get the stone because he wants it for a museum. And then I think like once he sees the children being used as the slave labor and being like whipped and hit and just like abused and all that shit, when he starts trying to save the children and then has that moment where he gets, you know, kidnapped and they pour that shit down his throat and then he turns evil for a little bit until the kid burns him with the torch and...
I do not remember any of this.
Yeah, because you probably fell asleep by this point. And then there's, like, after he gets burned and he wakes up from his little, like, nightmare, there's a point when, like, the Spielberg's wife, the very shrill, annoying... love interest in that movie.
The blonde one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, the one who just constantly screams and complains and cries and whatever else. There's a point when, you know, they're done, they're getting ready to get out, and she's like, okay, Andy, can we just get the hell out of here now? And he's like, right, all of us. And then it's literally like, they could get out, they could leave right then. He's got the stones. He doesn't have to stay, but they literally stay to get all those kids out.
Yeah.
And I think it's like a nice character arc, because then even at the end, when they go back to the village, he gives the stone back to the old guy that can't speak English. And then as he, I don't know if I told you about this, the guy that they got to play that like shaman or whatever from the village literally didn't speak a word of English. And Spielberg said that when he was shooting the scenes with him, he would have to basically like act for him behind the camera, and then the guy would just like mimic what he was doing. So he would learn the, he wouldn't even learn the lines, but he would say them phonetically. So like they'd be shooting the scene and then Spielberg would be like, it's like darkness, and then he would be like, it's like darkness, and then he would even do the hand motion of like over all the country, and then he would put his hands over his face and go over all the country. The guy's just like mimicking what Spielberg did. So it's I don't think the guy even knew what the fuck he was saying.
Did he get paid for those lines?
Probably, who knows. 84 politics, who the hell knows. But yeah, he gives the stone back to him, and then afterwards he's talking to Willie, the love interest, and she's like, you could have kept it, you know? And he's like, he kind of blows off. He's like, what would be the point of just being another, you know, they put it in a museum, it'd be another rock collecting dust. So it's like, oh, all of a sudden, and she even says, she's like, yeah, but then it would have given you your fortune and glory. And again, he just kind of tosses it off and is just like, hey, anything can happen. It's a long way to Delhi. So, you know.
Yeah.
Character progress. So it's almost like, actually, that would be interesting. When we rewatch them, let's do it chronological order.
Yeah.
Let's watch Temple of Doom.
Yeah.
Then Raiders. Then Last Crusade and Kingdom of the Crystal Skull.
Yes. I would like to do that. We should start it very early.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. To make sure we get through all four of them before June when the fucking movie comes out.
I just say so I don't fall asleep.
That early in the day. Yeah,
started too late. I might be out.
I don't know, man. It's got a Dolby Atmos track in that 4K. If we crank that shit up enough, that should at least keep you awake.
Yeah.
That's good. Let's plan that.
I would like to. Do you have the 4K or didn't come out yet?
No, I have the 4K.
You do? Okay.
What was I just thinking? Oh, that was something else I was going to tell you about. I did finally sit down over the weekend and watch the 2014 remake of RoboCop.
Really?
Yeah.
Who plays him?
Joel Kinnaman.
Where do I know him from?
Did you see Suicide Squad?
Ugh. Watch like 5 minutes.
Okay, he's in that.
How was it?
I'm not going to go into too much detail. I think I've already watched it. We can either watch it together or you can watch it on your own at some point. But I think we should make that as part of the So Nice They Made It Twice podcast, where we look at, you know, the original and the remake.
Yeah.
It's not bad, per se. It's a watchable movie. They change enough that it's not an exact remake, but it's one of those things where I'm watching it and I'm thinking, why? Like, more to the point, I'm more like, why is this RoboCop?
Yeah.
Is it just RoboCop because it's so close to it, even with your weird ideas, that, like, if you called it something else, people would say you just ripped off RoboCop, so you have to make it a RoboCop remake?
Oh, really?
And, again, I don't want to go into it too much until we get a chance to, you know, watch it and do, like, a legitimate discussion, but the big thing I took away from it, which is ironic, the video that I showed you from that Film Threat YouTube channel.
Yeah.
Where the guy was talking about, like, you know, the state of movies and,
you know,
all that other stuff. They have multiple people they interview for that channel. And I watched another video with some guy that they were talking about, and they were talking about, like, you know, remakes and sequels and this thing and that thing. And a major point the guy was talking about was less is more.
Yeah.
Less is more. You don't need to be overly complicated. You don't have to have overly complicated plots. Mm-mm. All these subplots and bullshit and everything else. He's like, it doesn't make your movie smarter. It doesn't make your movie better. You can have a very simple, straightforward idea and then done. Less is more.
Yeah.
And I kept thinking about that through this whole fucking movie, because the plot of original RoboCop is very straightforward and to the point. As you remember, it's literally like OCP is a company. They literally have bought up the city of Detroit. They plan on tearing it down and building a new place called Delta City over it. The big problem is the crime rate. They need to bring the crime rate down. They build their Ed 209 fucking killer machine that shoots that guy in the boardroom. And then it's like, he's like, I'm sorry. I'm sure it's just a glitch. And the old man's like, you called this a glitch?
Yeah.
Dick, I'm very disappointed in you. And then, you know, the dude from Twin Peaks, the other dude from Twin Peaks, is like, perhaps, sir, you've heard about my RoboCop program? And RoboCop was like the contingency program because the Ed 209 failed. And literally they say, oh, we're going to transfer potential subjects, people that are like the best qualified to be for this program, into the most crime-ridden districts in Detroit, to up the chances of them being killed in the line of duty.
Guns,
because
guns,
they're dead.
Guns, guns, guns.
So that's literally the whole plot. It's like Murphy is transferred to a really shitty department. He's almost immediately put into a really fucked up situation. And he is murdered by those like four or five guys. Like tortured and murdered. And then they harvest his now legally dead body. And they use it to make RoboCop. And the whole point is that it's just supposed to be like a humanoid cop inside a cyborg body. That's it. But then his memories start resurfacing.
Yeah.
And the whole rest of the movie is basically, how does a machine that was once a man reclaim what's left of his humanity? And that's it. And that's all you need. And then the revenge against, you know, guns, guns, guns,
guns, guns.
It's perfect.
Yeah.
And it's short. It's just over an hour and a half.
Love it.
Doesn't overstay its welcome. In contrast, remake of RoboCop is just over 2 hours. So right off the bat, I'm like, okay. They padded the runtime. And again, less is more. Original RoboCop plot, straightforward, streamlined, good. RoboCop remake, unnecessarily convoluted.
Why?
Because they threw in all the shit. It's not just that, oh, Murphy is just transferred to a district. No. It's that Murphy, by coincidence, is hurt and becomes a viable candidate for the program that they're already developing. And the reason he gets hurt is because, oh, he's working undercover with his partner. And they're trying to take down these, like, you know, drug dealers and stuff from the inside. But there's corruption within the police department. And possibly some of the cops in the department, you know, ratted him out. And now the villain of the movie has a hit out on him. And then he doesn't even get, like, tortured and, like, killed by the criminals, like, during a heist or anything. He literally is, like, car bombed.
Jesus.
Car bombed. As like an attempt to, you know, kill him because, oh, whatever. And I don't know. It just doesn't have the same kind of impact, because it's literally just like he goes up at the door of his car and then boom. And then he's like thrown back. And even then, like, I'm not a doctor. I don't know how this shit works. And but it's like, oh, his spinal cord was severed. He has burns over like 90% of his body, third degree, this thing, that thing. Like, he's going to lose vision in this eye. He's going to lose this leg. I'm like, was the explosion that I saw really that impactful? I mean, it was a CG explosion, so it gives a shit, but like, I'm like, I don't know if it would have done that, but whatever.
And
the villain in general, like the main villain, quote unquote main villain, is like bland and barely has anything to do with the plot. So again, it's like you go from like two significant, really good villains in the original RoboCop. You got the guy for OCP, who's the guy from Beverly Hills Cop, suddenly playing a villain, Ronnie Cox. He's great. And then obviously you've got Kurtwood Smith, better known as Red Foreman. That 70s show,
guns,
wearing glasses, going guns, guns, guns,
wearing glasses,
which is great. I love that little detail, like a badass like villain who's like balding and wearing fucking glasses, but he's terrifying.
He's terrifying.
It's great.
Yeah,
you go from that to like a villain whose name I can't even remember, and who I think in the movie when he's killed, spoiler. When he's killed, I think I didn't even realize he was dead at first. I was like, oh, wait, did RoboCop shoot him? Oh, shit, is he dead? Oh, well, what the fuck's the rest of the movie about? I don't know.
What year was this?
2014.
That's right, 2014.
Yeah. Again, I mean, no sense diving into it too much now until we get a chance to watch it and discuss it in conjunction with the original, but I don't know. Again, it's not god-awful like some remakes are, but it is ultimately forgettable. I can easily see myself forgetting almost all of this movie within like a week and forget that I ever watched it.
Well, here we go. Final rating.
Out of?
Hold on.
Oh.
Final rating. Would you buy that for a dollar?
They do work that in.
Fuck them.
They do work that in. It is fucking sad. Because there's literally a point where, did you see Watchmen?
I want to.
You saw Dark Shadows, though, right? The Tim Burton Dark Shadows?
Yeah.
Okay.
That's the
Johnny Depp one?
Yes.
The vampire one?
The vampire movie. Yeah.
Do you remember the guy that was like the groundskeeper Willie that he made into like his slave?
No, I'd have to rewatch it.
Ah, fuck it, it doesn't matter. So Jackie Earle Haley, the actor from Watchmen and from Dark Shadows and a couple other things. So he's in the movie and he's got a, like an antagonistic opinion of RoboCop, who he refers to as Tin Man throughout the whole movie. But there's one point where he's talking to Gary Oldman or Michael Keaton or somebody and he's like, blah, 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 blah. And he's like, and I sure wouldn't buy that for a dollar. I'm like, nah, you fucking douchebags.
Get the fuck out of here.
Yeah. And it's weird, it's like, and the cast is interesting. Like Joel Kinnaman is fine. I can't remember the name of the woman that played his wife, but she's okay. But she spends most of the movie just like crying. But I mean, they've got Gary Oldman.
Oh, really?
He's great. Yeah. They've got Michael Keaton. He's doing, you know, good stuff.
Sure.
They have Samuel L. Jackson, but his stuff is really out of place for me. That's the biggest thing I could think of that's like a difference between this and the original is like the original is a satire. It's funny in a lot of places. Yeah. It's uber violent and it's fucked up in places, but it is funny because it's a satire. And no more so than when they're doing like, which is, if you think about it, great exposition, when they do the news breaks in RoboCop where they have the people talk about this stuff so they can give you all this exposition, but they do it in this like matter of fact, like, newsreel thing, like when the satellite shot beams down and killed multiple people, including the president of whatever. And next up, and then they go to commercials and shit. The Samuel L. Jackson stuff is supposed to, I guess, fill that portion of it because he's basically like a almost like a Bill O'Reilly kind of thing, like a TV host who's just throwing out like political opinions and shit. Yeah. And they keep interjecting those randomly into the movie, and every time they do, it completely takes me out of it because those are satire, but the rest of the movie really isn't. It's a very more straightforward, like, action sci-fi movie. So it's like when you suddenly interject the comedic satire, it's like, what fucking movie is this supposed to be for? It almost feels like it was shot after the fact.
Yeah.
But
No.
It's less is more.
They shouldn't have been allowed to use that line.
Yeah.
Not unless your movie is gold.
Yes. They even used parts of the score.
Really?
Like, a little bit of the original RoboCop theme is used, but it's only used sporadically, which is, like, all it does then is remind me of a much better movie. Now, in fairness, because when I discussed it with Spencer last night, he brought up a very good point, which is that, you know, this remake doesn't... because he was saying how he remembers when the movie was coming out, so many people were like, how can you remake RoboCop? RoboCop is gold. RoboCop is great, a classic. And, you know... Now, I don't think his opinion of the original RoboCop and mine are quite on the same wavelength. I would consider RoboCop kind of a classic.
Yeah.
He maybe not so much, but he brought up a very good point, which is, yeah, you can complain all you want about tarnishing the IP of RoboCop by making a remake, but let's not forget about RoboCop 2 and 3 and the shitty TV series and the cartoon that they made. So it's like, yeah, well, all right. Yeah, a movie that was originally NC-17 or X at the time for violence spawned eventually a PG-13 sequel, an animated series, a TV series on network television, and now a 2014 PG-13 remake. So it's like,
We were supposed to watch RoboCop 2.
Yeah, when we do the So Nice They Made It Twice, we'll watch we'll watch all four. We'll watch
The trilogy all four.
And the, or at least RoboCop 2.
I'll watch RoboCop 2.
RoboCop 2.
I'm gonna fall asleep through the other.
I wouldn't blame you on RoboCop 3. It's pretty fucking bad.
And that's the PG-13 one.
Yeah, and it doesn't even have the original guy playing RoboCop. Even he wouldn't come back for that one. So it's like, oh shit.
Who was the original guy?
Peter Weller, the dude from Dexter, the one that what's his name hired. Quinn hired him to
in the season whatever.
Yeah, season four, I think. Yeah. Yeah, I think it was four. Yeah, that guy.
He's like a sleazy type. Yeah,
he plays sleazy very well.
Have you ever pointed that out before?
I think I did. I think when we watched it, I pointed it out. Yeah.
Yeah.
Because obviously, it's not like, except for the beginning of the movie, and he's much much younger in RoboCop than he was in Dexter. Like, once he gets turned into RoboCop, you never really fucking see his face until like the end of the movie. And yeah, but less is more.
Yeah. Should have grabbed some waters. Sorry about that.
Yeah, it's all good.
As I was setting up the stuff, I was like, don't worry, I'm going to grab some waters before he's done.
And then we just started. It's all good. You know what? Speaking of less is more, Top Gun Maverick, which we've never really talked about on this podcast. We still haven't watched it. I have. You have not.
I haven't even seen Top Gun.
You haven't. But again, that's the whole thing, is that I took McKinley to go see it. And he'd never seen the original Top Gun, and he was totally fine with it because, again, it is the same. I would put Top Gun Maverick up on the same level as Blade Runner 2049. Both are, in my opinion, great movies that are great sequels, not just because they're great sequels to an original, but because they are sequels that are not overtly dependent on the original for you to enjoy it. Top Gun Maverick has its own standalone story. If you've seen the first one and you know the characters that are coming back and you know the relationships and everything, yeah, it'll have more emotional impact for you watching this, but you don't need it to enjoy it, because everything that you might need a little bit of knowledge of for the first movie, they reference and they, you know, possibly show in a flashback. It's all you need. But again, less is more. The plot of Top Gun Maverick is so straightforward and streamlined without any excessive bullshit. It's fantastic. Especially for like an action movie, they know what the audience wants. They want the cool, you know, chases in the planes and everything, but using the practical, you know, real flying cameras mounted inside and outside the planes, no CG for that stuff. It all works great, and hey, let's give the audience a plot that they can follow. And I know I mentioned it before, but without getting into too much detail, what I love about it, which is so different than other action movies, especially like anything with like a military action going on, or any of like the fucking James Bond movies.
Yeah.
I can't tell you how many James Bond movies I have, you know, well, pretty much all of them that I've watched, where I can tell you what the plot was-ish.
Yeah.
And then, like, I can tell you in detail what happened up to a point, and then, like, the last half an hour when all the big action set piece stuff happens at the end, I couldn't tell you what was going on.
No.
I just know a bunch of people are shooting at each other and shit's blowing up.
Yeah.
And I know that James Bond wins.
Yep.
The end.
Yep.
That's about it. I couldn't tell you what it's, because it's all overly complicated.
Yeah.
But what's great about Top Gun Maverick is that because of the fact that it is specifically, hey, here's the mission. We're going to be going on this mission. And here's what the objective is. And because that mission requires Tom Cruise as Pete Maverick Mitchell to train these fighter pilots to do this thing, they have to first as exposition, but it's not technically exposition because they're showing it to the people that are going to be taught all this stuff. They literally show you on like a diagram, like on a screen, the layout. They're like, here's the objective. Here's where we're going. Here's the path we have to follow. Here are the obstacles. Here's what's going to happen. Here's what you have to do. You have to go here, here. You have to go from A to B to C to do D.
Yeah.
And then if that wasn't enough to train them on how to do it, they have to go through it as like practice runs. So by the time you get to the point in the movie when they actually have to go on the mission, you as the audience know exactly what the mission is. Hmm. You know exactly the mechanics of it.
Yeah.
You recognize what it is. And because they practice it so much, not only do you recognize it when it's happening, but you also can recognize and realize when something goes wrong. And you're like, oh, shit, no, they were supposed to do this at this point, but they couldn't because of this. And you're like, oh, fuck. Ah, it's so good.
I do want to watch it. It's I want to so watch good. It.
It's so good.
Yes.
The only issue I have with Top Gun Maverick is not with the movie itself. It is with its studio releasing it, Paramount Pictures.
Yeah.
I got no issue with Paramount as a studio. They're great. You know, they've got their stuff. They got their Top Gun. They got their Mission Impossibles. They got their Star Treks. They got all that stuff. They are pissing me off lately when it comes to their physical media. Now, it's not as bad as others. It's not as bad as good old Disney, who's like, either we're going to half-ass our releases or we're not going to put shit out at all mm-hmm. on physical disc. I know we talked about before that movie Barbarian. You know, I enjoyed it. It was decent. McKinley enjoyed it. Probably something that we might want to own. But guess what? Can only own it if you buy it digitally because they're not putting out a physical disc.
Yep.
Go fuck yourself. For lack of better words. But it's not as extreme as that. But like Paramount's been doing this thing that does annoy me where when they put out their 4K discs, and it doesn't matter what it is, it could be old movie, new movie, whatever, they have been packaging it as 4K disc and digital copy code.
Mm-hmm.
And that's it.
No
combined Blu-ray copy. Which is like, I get it, but you know what? 4K hasn't like fully taken, especially because as people keep saying physical media is dying, people haven't like fully embraced the 4K discs as much as you would think.
Yeah.
And it's specifically because it's not just a matter of like 4K discs require a 4K TV, which pretty much every TV you get now is a 4K TV, so that's not a big deal.
Yeah.
But like, oh, you need a 4K player
mm-hmm.
to play those discs. Not everybody has that. And even if they do, not everybody has it in like multiple rooms in their house. So you're limiting where you can watch the movie if you only have the 4K. And their, I'm sure, retaliation to that is, but you get the digital copy so you can watch it anywhere. Yeah, if you have internet access.
Yeah.
And if you feel like logging into your Vudu or Movies Anywhere account at somebody else's house.
Yeah.
A prime example is, again, Top Gun Maverick. Even though my parents are big fans of Tom Cruise, I think both of them would thoroughly enjoy that movie. But if I were to go up there to visit and bring that movie with me and I bought the regular edition of Top Gun Maverick, I wouldn't be able to
mm-hmm.
because they don't have Wi-Fi at the house because of the location they're in, and they do not have a 4K player.
Yeah.
So, whatever. Now, on a plus side with Top Gun Maverick, maybe they were like, oh, this movie made like, you know, upwards of like $1 billion. Maybe we should have multiple options available. But it annoys the piss out of me that the only way I could get a combo of the 4K with a Blu-ray and the digital is if I bought the limited edition Steelbook, which, I mean, I don't mind, but it's like, I'm paying more and it's limited edition. So it's like, oh, I can't even wait for it to go on sale because I don't know how limited is limited anymore. I got to buy it now.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, I bought it, but it's like, did I need to get that? And especially when it comes to the older releases, because they did the same thing with, what is it? Like the Addams Family.
Yeah.
That came out on 4K. 4K plus digital. That's it. But new movies as well. Sonic the Hedgehog 2.
Yeah.
I was going to get that for my kid for Christmas because he liked that movie.
Mm-hmm.
But I didn't get the 4K because, number one, for that, I don't really care. And he doesn't know the difference between 4K and Blu-ray. But because, again, 4K plus digital code. Okay. But where is he going to take it if he needs a physical disc where he's going to have access to a 4K player? So no, I ordered the Blu-ray combo pack instead. Untouchables. They brought that out finally. I don't even own Untouchables on Blu-ray. I only had it on DVD.
Yeah.
And I was like, oh, well, I'd definitely be able to upgrade now. I won't have to rebuy anything. But now it's like, oh, I only have the 4K because it's 4K and digital, no Blu-ray copy. You can't tell me that, especially for old releases like that, Untouchables, Beverly Hills Cop 2, Adam's Family, whatever else,
yeah,
movies that have already been on Blu-ray before, you can't tell me that Paramount doesn't have in their warehouses multiple unsold copies of the Blu-ray that was put out before. I'm not saying put out a remastered Blu-ray as well. Take those discs, the old Blu-ray that have already been released before, take the disc out, throw out the old packaging, and put that disc on a second hub in the packaging for the 4K.
Yeah.
Just, you don't even have to press new discs. You take what's already in existence that you're not going to do anything with anyway and put it in the package and ship it out.
Mm-hmm.
Like, why is that so hard?
Yeah.
I don't get it.
Why?
And it's the two that I think are most guilty of that right now. They're the biggest because they're a major studio. That's Paramount. And then I know Arrow Media. They've been coming out with like really, really good stuff. And they come out with 4K sets. But most of the time, if they come out with stuff in 4K, they do not make it a 4K Blu-ray combo. Like my copy of Flash Gordon that I got from Arrow. It's 4K only.
Yeah.
True Romance. I had to get that as the limited edition steelbook from Arrow because that's the only way to get it as a combo with a Blu-ray.
What's True Romance again?
Quentin Tarantino's technically his first movie. He just didn't direct it.
Yeah.
Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, same thing. I had to order a limited edition steelbook that came with the Blu-ray and the 4K because otherwise it's just 4K.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's the one with De Niro.
Yes.
Yeah.
So I don't know. That whole thing is like, you know that physical media is dying. And your way of solving that issue when you put out releases is to limit the access that people have to these movies when, like, obviously the need is there or the desire is there to own these things. I don't understand it.
Mm-hmm.
But that would be my only qualm with Top Gun Maverick. It has nothing to do with the movie. It just has to do with Paramount's decision for releasing the film.
Yeah, it's really sad because almost every Blu-ray came with a DVD.
Almost, yeah.
Almost. They started doing it with the Blu-rays. At the start. But then you had the 4K, and they included the Blu-ray, mm-hmm. which was nice.
And most
companies
still do.
How much are they saving by not doing that?
Yeah, I can't even imagine. Well, again, like I said, like even when they've done it before, like the 4K of It's a Wonderful Life that I have, which is from Paramount, that was a 4K and Blu-ray combo pack.
Yeah.
And it, exactly like what I said, the Blu-ray copy that was included is not the remastered Blu-ray that they put out. They at least released separately a remastered Blu-ray. But the one that included in their 4K set is not the remastered Blu-ray. It's the old Blu-ray that they already had put out. And then the 4K is the remastered 4K disc.
Oh.
So obviously they took a bunch of the old Blu-rays that had not sold and just put it into the double pack.
Put it in there.
Like, how hard is that?
Mm-hmm.
You and I both know from having worked in retail for a number of years, you remember the recalls that we used to do.
Yes.
When they would send us like hundreds of copies of a certain movie that was a new release.
Yep.
And then, hey, half of them sat in the back room for months because we never needed that many. And then we would get a mandatory recall and they'd all have to go back so we could get whatever the discount was for having returned copies back. They're going back to the studio, the distributor, whoever. What do you think they do with them? Mm-hmm. Either they're going to ship them out to other stores where they're going to sell them at like discount prices so they can be sold at like fucking Big Lots or wherever for like super cheap or in the $5 bin at Walmart.
Yeah.
Or do that. Take the DVD, take the Blu-ray copy out, toss out your case that probably costs you 10 cents to make and put it in the new case for the 4K and make it a combo pack. It's not hard. I wouldn't think. I mean, I'm not in the business, but I don't think it's that hard to do that.
No.
I've actually it's gotten to a point where I'm so annoyed with stuff like that that it's annoying to me because then I can't even like get rid of my old Blu-ray copy of something if I'm upgrading. Like I can't sell it to like offset the cost of having bought the 4K if they don't include it as a combo pack. But it's also annoying to me just for like a space saving situation of like why should I have to have a separate Blu-ray and a separate 4K copy of the same movie on my shelf taking up space when I'm literally probably only going to watch the 4K from now on, but I want the option.
Yeah.
So I've even gotten to the point, I have a bunch of those like paper CD sleeves where I've taken my Blu-ray copy off the shelf, taken the disc out of the case and put the case somewhere in storage. And I'll put the Blu-ray in the paper sleeve and I'll open the 4K case and I'll slip the paper case into the little like the holders. Yeah. Where they used to put like the inserts inside a case, but they don't do inserts anymore. So I'll just put it in there. So that way I have the Blu-ray disc inside the case for the 4K. I make my own combo pack. Your bitch. Own combo.
Yeah, that's sad.
It is. Happy holidays.
Well, that's it.
It is pandering to one's audience and demographic. You're a physical media fan. Here. Have this.
Here's a little something.
Yeah, here's a little something. Not everything you'd want, but like, yeah, here you go.
Yeah.
Or like, yeah, yeah, we'll give you your 4K Blu-ray combo pack, but only in a limited edition steelbook. Because obviously you're collectors. You need the limited edition steelbook for $10 more. It's pandering. Mm-hmm. Speaking of pandering, there was another discussion that we've talked about this before, and I'm not going to rehash the entire situation because it is technically a hot button topic right now. But I did want to discuss a blog post that I saw from DC Comics on their official. It was sent, the link to it was attached inside an official email from DC Comics, because I'm on their email subscription list. And it is to the official DC Comics blog, and it has to do with the elephant in the room, which is Tim Drake Robin, the third, and many, including myself, would argue, the best Robin that there ever has been, and his brand new, out of nowhere, change in sexuality.
I don't think we ever talked about this.
No.
Well, I mean, me and you.
Well,
we haven't talked.
No,
about
we haven't talked about it on here. No. You and I have talked about it privately. Yeah, it is a hot button topic. It is one of those things that we don't talk about too often because, again, it's one of those things where if you say this doesn't make sense or this doesn't work for the character,
right,
or this writing is terrible, it seems like the general consensus from certain parts of the public is, and from the creators themselves, are like, well, you know what, if you don't like it, then you're a bigot, you're a homophobe, you're a racist, you're right, you know, a misogynist, you're whatever. It's been going on for,
they'll try to shame you.
Yes.
Yeah. No, it's not the case at all. You're just like,
right, it's
I just, you know, this was my favorite character. I just,
yeah. And it's, and it has nothing to do with the change itself.
Yeah.
It is having to do with the events around the change, the way that they're handling the change, and the fact that like the way they're doing it isn't organic to the character. It is, in my opinion, very much pandering to one's audience to try and sell, not even so much to sell the book, but more like to make headlines.
Yeah.
You know, Tim Drake Robin, hey, guess what? He's bisexual and he's going to have a boyfriend now. Where did that come from? Yeah, we don't know.
Yeah.
But you know what? It's headline. And it's a very good point. It's something that in one of the quotes I'm going to read comes up. The general public, if they see these headlines, they don't know the difference between Tim Drake, Dick Grayson, Jason Todd, Damian Wayne, Carrie right. Kelly. They don't know who any of those people are. They know Robin. Mm-hmm. They know the character Robin.
Yeah.
They know what Robin looks like. They know who Robin is. Again, something I think we might have talked about before. It's the reason why, even though it's a cheesy line in Dark Knight Rises,
mm-hmm.
when you get to the end of Dark Knight Rises and you have Joseph Gordon-Levitt as, I think his name in the movie is John Drake, or John Blake, John Blake, sorry.
John Blake.
And you get to the end of the movie where, you know, they think that Bruce Wayne is dead and he's, you know, been left something by Bruce Wayne. So he goes to the office and he's talking to the woman there and he's like, oh yeah, there's something, they said there's something here for me. You know, Blake, John, she's like, I got nothing. There's nothing here for you. And he's like, oh, sorry. Here, try my legal name. And then she finds the bank. She's like, oh, here we go. And she's like, oh, you know what? You should start using your real name. I like that name, Robin.
Oh.
Now, okay. That's kind of cheesy.
Yeah.
And because his name was John Blake, I don't know why they couldn't have named him John Drake.
Yeah.
And then had his name actually be Tim Drake, his legal name.
Right.
Or have his legal name be like, you know, Richard Grayson or whatever. But then I realized, but you know what? It's a movie.
Yeah.
And general public watching, like hardcore comic fans, are going to know exactly who you're talking about when you name drop Tim Drake. But if you name drop, you know, Tim Drake to a, if you name drop Tim Drake to my mother,
right,
she doesn't know who that is. My mother knows who Robin is.
Yeah.
General public for like the last 50, 60 years, they know who Robin is.
Yeah.
So I think that's more of like making Tim Drake, you know, bisexual, gay, whatever, for the sake of the headlines.
Mm-hmm.
It's not so much that they made him that, it's the fact that they made Robin that. Now, why they couldn't make Damian Wayne Robin that way?
Yeah.
That would make more sense to me because he hasn't been in existence for that long. Damian Wayne has only been around maybe 10 years now, if that.
Okay.
As a character. And he's still relatively young. Like, when he started out, I want to say he was like 11 or 12, maybe, as a character, right, age-wise. And I think, like, that makes a lot more sense. Like, having, like, the character of Damian Wayne suddenly, like, discovering his own sexualities, he's going through life, and,
right,
you know, maybe it was something, because he was raised by Ra's al Ghul in the League of Shadows. He's the son of Bruce Wayne and Talia al Ghul that Bruce Wayne didn't know he had for years.
Right.
And he was raised by the League of Assassins. Maybe the League of Assassins were, you know, bigoted and narrow-minded and would have looked down upon those inclinations. So maybe he's like repressed it for years growing up and being trained to be an assassin, and like, as, but once he's like under the tutelage of his own father,
right,
he has to suddenly, like, you know, come to terms with it, or he's allowed to come to I don't know.
There's a lot of different ways
and that's my big thing with it, is that the way, and again, I'll admit I haven't read the whole arc, I haven't read the issues leading up to it, but everything that I've read about it seems to say that it pretty much just happened within like a 4-issue arc with no pretext whatsoever. Like, oh, by the way, apparently Tim Drake likes boys. And now he's going on a date with a guy named Bernard that he was established in the comics before, who's been gone from the books for years, and then all of a sudden comes back and it's like, oh, by the way, did you know that Bernard was gay? Oh, well, they're going to be gay together. Huh. Because reasons.
Yeah.
And it's like, whatever.
Why would they do something like this?
Because it gets your name in the headlines.
I don't understand.
It puts it in the newspapers. It makes the headline. We're talking about it now, which no one's really talked about Tim Drake Robin in like any major context for years. Hmm. So if you wanted to make headlines, mission accomplished. But I don't think they're doing anything interesting with the character. It's boring the way they're doing it. And now with the new book that they have coming out from Megan Vince Martin, who I looked her up, and she's known for writing like 2 episodes of Supernatural and some like a couple episodes of some DC animated shows.
Huh.
And then pretty much all her comic book work that I can see listed is all the stuff with Tim Drake and his, you know.
But she's a fan of the old comics, right?
Yeah, I'm sure she is. I'm sure she is. But in any case, I don't know. It's been an issue for me because, like, when reading the first issue of that book that she wrote now, which is, again, another standalone Robin book, which is cool. I'm all for that. But that first issue is, like, 80% I'd say, at least, about his relationship with Bernard, and then the rest of it's about him being Robin. But it's so, I don't know how it's going to develop as the comic goes. It's just badly written and badly drawn. I just have no desire to read the rest of it.
When was this character created?
1988, I believe. 88 or 89.
Yeah.
So he's been around for a while. But you know what? Let me get into the thing that got me so annoyed, which would be the blog post. I may have to read this whole thing just to give this context, so it may be a while. So you few listeners, strap in, because I'm going to have to do a lot of reading here. The main reason, the impetus for this article, apparently, so this was published on the DC blog. So this is dc.com/blog. This is written by a gentleman named Joshua Lappin Bertone. Sure. Published on November 10th, 2022. The reasoning for it is because, which is another thing, is like one way or the other, if anyone in the future decides that they want to do something different with Tim Drake's character, they're really not going to be able to retcon this.
You said this was on, but this was published like DC's website?
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. So okay. This is like an official thing. I don't know how official the person is who wrote the article, but he's writing it for the blog that is on DC's site.
Right.
So, I mean, that's his, and I became aware of the article from an email that I got from DC's mailing list.
Yeah.
So it's like, no, this is as official as it gets. And the reason for it is because apparently now they're working this in, not just in the existing comics, but now they're trying to like really cement it by working it into any form of media that Tim Drake is involved in. First of all, I know that they've now worked it into the new Gotham Knights game that came out. They worked in his relationship with Bernard in that. And now they're introducing Bernard and working in the relationship potentially in the Titans TV show. So
they're really going for it.
They're really going for it. So the title of the article, Tim and Bernard, Titan's most intriguing relationship takes shape. Okay? So here we go. And keeping in mind, I am now literally just reading the article. We were thrilled to see Jim Drake's iconic bow staff make its debut in the season 4 premiere of Titans. But if Tim seemed a little extra happy about it to you, that probably has something to do with the person who gave it to him, Bernard Fitzmartin. By the way, which they mention here, Bernard in the comics is named Bernard Dowd. They name him Bernard Fitzmartin on the show after Megan Fitzmartin, the author of the comics. Fantastic. Anyway, played on the series by James Scully, Bernard is a new character to Titans, but he's certainly not new to fans of Batman's third Robin. Tim Drake's history with Bernard, whose name is Bernard Dowd in the comics, began almost 20 years ago, but it was only recently that it truly developed into something worth celebrating. We don't know yet how the relationship between Tim and Bernard is going to play out on Titans, but let's see how things have unfolded in the comics for hints as to where things might be headed. So, spoiler, this is now going to literally deep dive into pre-existing comics and try and basically, for lack of a better term, justify the decisions they've made with both characters now by pointing out things in previous comics that none of these writers have worked on and literally reading between the lines, being like, well, because of this, maybe this was hinting at this, maybe this was hinting at that, whatever. Let's proceed. So last year, Tim Drake reunited with his old schoolmate, old school classmate Bernard in Batman Urban Legends 4 through 6. After an adventure involving kidnappers and a bit of self-reflection, Tim asked Bernard out on a date, setting the stage for a new era of his life. It wasn't an immediate yes from Bernard. Like Tim, Bernard also needed some time to come to grips with his sexual identity, and that isn't too surprising. After all, Bernard Dowd wasn't originally conceived as a queer character. So, right off the bat, they flat out say he wasn't originally conceived that way. But this is where it says, after all, Bernard Dowd wasn't originally conceived as a queer character, at least as far as we know. But it's surprising how much his early appearances laid the groundwork for that revelation. Okay. Before reappearing in Batman Urban Legends number 4, Bernard was a memorable but underused supporting character in Tim's life with only 6 appearances in the DC Universe, the most recent happening in 2005. It is now 2022. Okay? He's been gone from the comics for that long. That was me talking, by the way. So back to the article. He was introduced in Robin number 121 when Tim Drake began his junior year at Louis E. Grieve High School. Bernard is immediately drawn to Tim and starts sizing him up, trying to figure out where Tim fits in the high school social structure. It's vital, he tells Tim, a place for everyone and everyone in their place. That's how the world works. It sounds a lot like Bernard is trying to fit into a role he thinks society expects him to be in. Okay. As the conversation goes on, Bernard threatens to, quote-unquote, punish Tim, ! And tells him not to date any girls he has a crush on. At the time, Bernard just seemed like an eccentric best friend, but this scene takes on a whole new context after reading Batman Urban Legends number 6. Things only got more interesting with his next appearance in Robin number 122. Tim and Bernard are hanging out at a diner when popular girl Darla Acquista walks in. Bernard tells Tim that he has a crush on Darla, and the popular jocks that she hangs out with won't ever give him room to make his play. What should we make of Bernard's confession here? Although we now know Bernard is queer, that doesn't mean he never had a crush on Darla. The journey to discovering your own sexual identity can be long, and it's possible Bernard was still working out his feelings. Another interpretation is that Bernard was closeted at the time and pretended to have a crush on Darla in order to assert his heterosexuality. Darla would be the perfect person for this since her social status makes her unavailable. Tim calls Bernard's bluff and convinces the jocks to let Dowd ask Darla out. Bernard is livid, and his mood is worsened when Darla expresses a romantic desire for Tim. Reading this in 2004, we're meant to believe that Bernard is bummed out because he wanted Darla for himself. But filtered through a 2022 lens, we can't help but wonder if his journey came from his feelings for Tim. Oh, sorry, wonder if his jealousy came from his feelings for Tim. Okay.
Well, this is...
It sure is. We're still going.
Okay,
so the fallout was seen in Robin number 123. Tim, who was dating Stephanie Brown at the time, Stephanie Brown, by the way, side note from me, is the one that I told you about who he was in a relationship with for years and years in the comic. And then when this whole thing with Bernard came about, she's the one that they had show up at the end of the one issue where he's going to introduce her to Bernard as his, you know, boyfriend. And she's like, Bernard, it's so nice to meet you. Best day ever. Yeah, I don't know about that as far as a first reaction, but anyway. So Tim, who was dating Stephanie Brown at the time, protests to Bernard that he has no designs on Darla, insisting that he already has a girlfriend. Bernard is less than convinced. Where is this mysterious Stephanie what's-her-name, he asks. Why have I never met her? If you've got something you want to tell me, then speak up. We're buds. I'll understand. We're two modern enlightened men in the third millennium, Drake. No need to make up imaginary girlfriends. Wow. Where to begin? Bernard is clearly teasing Tim, but this scene has a deeper meaning in light of recent revelations. Bernard is practically begging Tim to come out of the closet, but he's doing it in the guise of a joke to save face. Maybe Bernard is using these comments to test the waters, to see how Tim would react. The conversation is meant to send a clear message to Tim. If you're queer, it's not a big deal, and you can tell me. The scene ends with Bernard warning Tim about the dangers of dating Darla. Interpret what you will from that. Okay. In Robin number 126, this is very, very deep, deep into this. Like, the attempt to justify all this is bizarre. Okay. In Robin number 126, Bernard is a guest at the Drake household for dinner time, where he spends the entire meal fawning over Tim's stepmother, Dana. Once he and Tim have a moment alone, Bernard begins gushing about how attracted he is to Dana. Yet again, this is a scene that makes more sense if you suspect Bernard is hiding his sexual identity. He's trying to play the role of horny heterosexual teenager, and he's seriously overcompensating. As he did with Darla, Bernard has also chosen an unobtainable female to be the object of his desire. Tim may have called his bluff with Darla, but Dana is a safe target. There's no way Tim's going to encourage his buddy to ask out his stepmom. Bernard was seen again in Robin number 127 hanging out with Tim and Darla. He shared some conspiracy theories about Batman working for a shadowy government, unaware that he was standing next to the Dark Knight's partner. Unfortunately, this would be the last time Bernard would share a scene with Tim for 17 years.
Huh.
Not 17 years in comic time, right, obviously, right. But 17 years between his last appearance in the comics and when they brought him back for this.
Right.
After the events of War Games, Louis E. Grieve High School permanently closed and Tim moved to Bloodhaven. Bernard was seen again in Robin number 140 when Darla sought his help in tracking down Tim. Bernard told her that they had lost touch after their school had closed down, but pointed her towards Bloodhaven. Darla continued her quest without Bernard, who wasn't seen again until 2021's Batman Urban Legends number 4. In it, Tim reunites with Bernard for the first time in years, sharing a meal at a fancy restaurant. Unfortunately, the reunion is cut short when Bernard is kidnapped by a cult leader known as the Chaos Monster. Tim's search for Bernard leads him to the Dowd household, where Tim makes an interesting observation regarding his parents. Quote, "They always wanted everything just so perfectly placed, and Bernard never quite measured up to their standards," Tim muses. Remember what Bernard first told Tim when they met about everything having a place? That statement suddenly makes more sense, as does some of Bernard's old behaviors. Reading between the lines, one could conclude that Bernard was hesitant to confront his own sexuality because of his repressive parents. We are very much reading between the lines at this point. Okay. We're almost done, don't worry. When Robin rescues Bernard in Batman Urban Legends number 6, the captive teen tells the Boy Wonder to pass a message to Tim Drake in case they don't make it out alive. Quote, "Tell Tim Drake he helped me realize my true self, who I am," unquote. Of course, Robin is an old pro at rescuing people, so Bernard makes it out safely, unaware that his rescuer was none other than Tim Drake. The story concludes with Tim visiting Bernard, who formally asks him out on a date. Tim accepts, and fandom rejoiced. I don't know which fandom he's speaking of, because I don't know that much of the overall fandom that was waiting for this moment, because it apparently just came up in this like 6-issue series, but anyway. So, Tim's journey has been a frequent topic of discussion, but Bernard's evolution is worth examining as well. Since Bernard is not the protagonist, we don't have the benefit of getting inside his head the way we do with Tim. However, his words and actions have given us some big pieces of the puzzle, enough to form a picture. Like Tim, Bernard wasn't sure who he was or where he fit into things. Living under repressive parents, he denied aspects of his own identity. Eager to play the role his parents and society expected of him, Bernard acted like a hormonal high school student and purposely sought out girls who were unobtainable. According to what he told Robin, Tim Drake, Tim Drake helped him realize who he truly was. Of course, Tim and Bernard on Titans are older and seem already comfortable in their sexuality. All right, I'm not going to go on the rest of this, but yada, 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 yada.
That article is just silly.
Hang on. Let me at least read the last paragraph.
Okay.
So Titans Bernard and Tim, who's played by Jay Lycurgo, I don't know how to say his name, will have their own unique story, and however it plays out, it's another example of some welcome LGBTQIA+ representation within the Bat family and DC multiverse in general. And in what's truly a rarity in the superhero world, both versions of the relationship will be defined at the same time. Will Tim and Bernard break up in the TV series and ride off into the sunset in the comics? That could happen, but so could the opposite. Or perhaps they'll get a happy ending in both. No matter what goes down on Titans and in Tim Drake's current comic series, Bernard has helped make one thing very clear to Robin number 3 and his fans. This is who Tim is.
Right. So that article is completely silly.
Mm-hmm.
It's fake. Uh-huh. It's disingenuous. Everybody knows disingenuous. Everybody knows it's just made for the whole Bernard thing and Robin thing. It's made for headlines.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know much about it. I can't talk about the comics. Never read them.
Right.
But it's clear that that's what's going on.
It's trying to find justification for doing not a stunt. What's the word I'm looking for? They're trying to do something to make headlines.
Yes.
By taking like a viable topic right now,
mm-hmm,
and doing something to be like, look at how progressive we are. Look, mm-hmm, at what we've done. Look at all this. And by doing it, they're doing it, but they're doing it in such a lazy way with a character that does not have any pre-laid foundation for this as a thing.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to justify it to us and to themselves, they have to dig deep into previous stuff that's already been put out and basically be like, oh, yeah, well, it's this.
Right.
And it's like, no, it's not.
Whoever wrote that, mm-hmm, acknowledged in that article, or sorry, blog post, that the original creator for that character didn't conceive him to be gay.
Right. Yeah, it's and
yet he's going back to the original source material and trying to find evidence of him being gay, even though he just stated that the person who what's the guy's name who created him?
Oh, who created Tim Drake? Marv Wolfman, and then Chuck Dixon is the guy who kind of like wrote him for the bulk of
right
his, you know, initial time as the character.
It's just, it's crazy.
I'm trying to find, where is the... Okay, so, yeah, this is where it annoys me, because then it's like, you could, and again, there's nothing wrong
no.
with doing that to the character, but you need to at least have it be a natural progression, yes. some kind of groundwork laid before. It's very, very difficult to take a pre-existing character who's been around, like, in real time for us, has been yeah. around since 1988, and has been getting developed ever since, and then all of a sudden within this last year be like, well, he's always been this way. And I understand, you know, not everyone comes to the realization at the same time, but they're right. also doing it as a very, like, knee-jerk, really quick, like, hey, this needs to happen.
Yes.
Boom. Here it is. And it's like, what? Where did that come from?
Mm-hmm.
And now it's like, to justify it, you have to dig deep into previous issues and yeah. be like, well, read between the lines. And it's like, read between what? Like, it's one thing to, like, You watch a movie and you try and interpret it because you only have, like, the visuals to go by or whatever else. And it's like, when you're reading, like, a comic, especially when they have inner monologues, like, if there was stuff going on that these characters were meant to be thinking, they usually will tell you because yeah. that's the inner monologue. And you can't say, like, well, we don't know what the character would have been thinking. Yeah, we do, because somebody wrote all their thoughts.
Yeah.
It doesn't make any sense. I mean, and... Uh-huh. So then after that, I found these quotes here. What is his name? Okay. So I guess the guy that created the character Bernard in when he was doing his run on the Robin comic, his name is Bill Willingham, or Willingham. I don't know how you pronounce it.
Bill Billiam.
And there's a quote that is apparently off of his own site commentary. So he wrote... This revelation has been dealt with, but pro and con to an exhaustive extent, both pro and con to an exhaustive extent in other articles, videos, and so forth, so I won't retread that here. Even though I wrote the character of Tim Drake for just over a year of his Robin run, he's not mine. I didn't create him. Through the retroactive legal magic of work for hire, DC Comics created him, owns him, and can do whatever, in its corporate wisdom, it wants with him. But I just want to deal a bit with the other guy, the fellow Tim Drake plans to be gay with. The character's name is Bernard Dowd, and I created him. Here's his first appearance in my first issue, writing Robin. Yes, I know when dealing with work for hire, it means DC Comics actually created him, as I admitted above. But before the retroactive reality imposed itself, I conceived the character, wrote his first appearance, wrote many subsequent appearances, and decided who he would be and who he wouldn't be. Only then, by submitting those stories and accepting DC's paycheck, the magic kicked in, and it turns out DC created everything all along. As originally conceived, Bernard Dowd was many things, but he wasn't gay. I can know this for a certainty because, unlike living historical figures, it's possible to know the secret inner workings of a fiction character because they are whatever the author wrote them to be. And in this case, Bernard Dowd liked girls. He had a crush on Tim Drake's hot stepmother, and that's about it for the romantic sexual front. There were no other deep hidden secrets to uncover. No big deal.
That's a good response.
That is coming from
a good response.
The mouth of the guy who created the character Bernard. And that's the thing that we talked about before is, for me, the better thing to do would be like, just create your own character. Create your own character.
Yes.
Develop them whatever you yeah. want. If you want to make that part of who the character is, that's fine. You know, spread it out. Let you know, be part of who the character is, juggling this while also juggling being a superhero, whatever. But the thing is, a new character doesn't make headlines.
Nope.
Because a new character doesn't have that public knowledge. Yeah. Like, people don't... Like, if you created somebody called, Hawk Boy or, you know...
Right.
Titanium or whatever... And oh, that character is, you know,
other names?
I don't know. I'm trying to think of like a lame name that they would think of like for a superhero character, but like whatever. You create a new right. superhero character and you're like, hey, it's going to be very progressive. It's going to be of the time. It's going to be of, you know, reflective of today's readers and everything else. And be like, cool. But you know what? Nobody knows who that is.
Nope.
And the only thing that's going to make headlines is that you made a character that's this. And I'm sure there's going to be somebody who will be like, yeah, but that's not brave. You created a new character. That's not brave. You need to make a pre-existing character, you know, to be that. And it doesn't make sense. So, you know, if you make so-and-so unnamed character, you know, gay, bisexual, whatever, doesn't make headlines, but right. you suddenly come out and say, no pun intended, you suddenly come out and say, hey, Robin is gay, or Robin is bisexual, or whatever else, or Robin is gender fluid, I don't know.
It's going to stir the pot.
That yeah. is going to make you headlines. That's going to be like, oh, well, you know what? Wow, Robin, really? And that's the thing. And I think where the pandering comes in is that they probably, again, I have no inner knowledge of this. I don't know how this all came down. But it's that idea of, okay, well, Robin is a pre-established character. We're going to now say that he is gay, bisexual, whatever, and we need to give him a boyfriend. But if you created a new character out of nowhere to be his boyfriend, there's probably going to be a huge group of people who'll be like, oh, gee, so Robin, Tim Drake, he suddenly likes guys, and out of nowhere comes this amazing person who's suddenly going to make him, like, see who he really is. Like, well, that's kind of convenient, isn't it? So then DC and their wisdom is like, well, we can't just do that. We need to bring in a pre-existing character so we can say that this has been a thing the whole time. Who was he friends with? Did he have any guy friends? And then whoever's, like, their, you know, continuity expert is like, I think there was some guy named Bernard that he hung out with when he was in high school. When was the last time he was in the comic? I don't know, like 17 years ago? Well, can we bring him back? Yeah, sure. Can we make him gay? Yeah, why not? Because, again, it's, you know, work for hire. When you're work for hire,
yeah,
you don't own any of your shit.
Right.
Like, all that shit, like, as soon as, like you said, as soon as he handed in his stuff and accepted DC's paycheck, it's not yeah. his anymore. It doesn't yeah. matter if he created it or not.
Uh-huh.
It's like a good example was, like, Frank Miller, who wrote for, you know, Daredevil for a number of years back in the 80s. He didn't create the character of Daredevil, but he did create the character of Elektra.
Yeah.
But he can't use Elektra in any other media. Anything that he does on his own outside of Marvel, he can't use Elektra as a character, even though he created her, because he created her for Marvel. Marvel owns the character, work for hire. But that's another topic for another day.
Right, right. But it's just the fact that they did it to an already established
yeah.
character that's been around since the 80s.
Yeah. And I mean, all right, so
before like they wouldn't do that to Superman.
I mean, you know, okay. So here's the thing. When researching this, I found obviously that quote from the guy that created Bernard. I did find, which I'll read in a minute, a quote from Chuck Dixon, who is a guy who was very much responsible for creating a lot of the continuity for Tim Drake Robin and a lot of the development, because he wrote many, many issues of Robin's standalone book when that came out. But Tim Drake was not created by Chuck Dixon. Tim Drake was actually created by legendary writer Marv Wolfman. And Marv Wolfman, coincidentally, in a collection that I have of A Death in the Family, the storyline where the second Robin, Jason Todd, was murdered by the Joker, which then leaves an opening for a new Robin, it also combines that with the four-part storyline, or five-part storyline, A Lonely Place of Dying, which is the one that establishes Tim Drake and sets him up being the third Robin. So for that, good old Marv Wolfman wrote an introduction as to what happened as far as him getting the job and what was his plan, I guess, or his what was he needing to do when creating this Robin. So because I couldn't find any quotes from Marv Wolfman discussing the current situation with Tim Drake, I am deferring to this, where he discusses, and this predates a lot of this stuff, him reminiscing about having created Tim Drake as a character. So he says, and I quote, "It's been slightly over 20 years since I got the phone call. I remember it coming from Barbara Randall, who had been my associate editor on the Noon Titans, but as her name is not on the original stories, I may be wrong. Anyway, I remember Barbara telling me that Batman editor Denny O'Neill wondered if I had any ideas for a new version of Robin that they wanted to introduce after the recent murder of Jason Todd." He's recovered since then, which is true. Jason Todd is now the Red Hood. But that's, again, another story for another day. So he said, let me back up a bit. "When artist George Perez and I started the new Teen Titans back in 1980, we began the gradual process of aging then-Robin Dick Grayson. Until then, Robin was approximately 15 to 16 years old, and while in the middle of fighting villains and such, he tended to spout bad puns. That didn't work for the book I wanted to write, so we bumped his age up to 18 or so, got rid of the puns, and gave him a brain instead. I'm not putting down the old Robin. As a kid, I loved him, but times had changed, and the character that was created in April of 1940 needed to be updated. Besides, in the Titans, he was no longer a sidekick. He was the team leader, and he needed to know what he was doing. So little Robin grew up and left the Batman book to take full-time residence in Titans Tower. Flash forward to 1983, the Batman books wanted Robin back, and they wanted to de-age him to the younger teen he was before we changed him. Their thought was simply that Robin was a necessary component of the Bat titles. The expression is Batman and Robin, after all, not Batman and some kid named Joey. But I loved writing Dick Grayson, the Dick Grayson character, so in a move motivated totally by greed, I suggested that it would be wrong to de-age Dick Grayson, since the readers now liked the older, more serious version, and, though it had never been done before, why couldn't the Bat title simply create a new Robin? I changed Dick's hero name in the Titans to something else, Nightwing. He'd grow up and would now want his own name, after all, while DC could call attention to the Bat titles by introducing a brand new, younger Robin. This could be a win-win scenario, so in a few short months, the character of Jason Todd was introduced and a new Robin was born.
Hmm.
Not long afterward, I moved to Los Angeles. Time moved on, continents rose and sank, and the next thing I knew, it was 1988, and Jason Todd had been murdered. By both the Joker and the readers, Batman was Robinless again. I never did find out why I got the call asking what I'd do to create yet another Robin, but I do remember thinking that in the past, Robin was always groomed to become Batman. Should the original die? Batman die? Yeah, that'll happen. But why not have a Robin who wanted to not be Batman, but, shock of shocks, Robin? Why not create a character who was so smart that he could deduce that Dick Grayson was Robin, and that meant that Bruce Wayne was Batman? Tim Drake, named for upcoming Batman director Tim Burton, was brilliant, trained himself to become Robin, and making him completely different from all previous kid psychics, he would have his own family outside of the lead character. Tim's mother and father had no connection to Bruce Wayne and company. DC liked my take and had me put together a story to introduce him to the world. In order to call further attention to him, the story would move from Bat titles to the Titans, DC's most popular title at the time, and back and forth again. I got to work with regular Batman artist Jim Aparo, as well as my Titans partner George Perez. It doesn't get better than that. As for the story, I wanted us to use my favorite Batman villain, Two-Face. If ever there was a villain who needed to be psychoanalyzed, it's Harvey Dent's alter ego. I tried to explore his dual psyche as well, as coming up with some different kinds of Two-Face capers. We don't need to talk about that. I tried to put together a story that would make the readers like Tim almost from day one. That would also make them realize that Batman needed a partner, not only to help him fight bad guys, but to force him to stay human, to remember why he was doing what he was doing, and to prevent him from getting too much into his own head, as they say. Batman without Robin can too easily forget the victims of crime and instead only concentrate on the perpetrators. As Batman himself is a victim of crime, he needs Robin to remind him that the fist alone can't solve the true cost of crime. It also needs to be solved with the heart. I always liked him. I thought that giving him his own family made him stand apart from all the kid heroes we'd seen before. I thought that making him want to be a sidekick and not the main hero meant that he'd not be riddled with angst, already steadily creeping into comics, but that he'd enjoy what he was doing. Fans had not always appreciated Jason Todd, and it was risky to introduce yet another Robin and hope the readers would take to him. But 20 years later, Tim is still fighting the good fight, and that pleases me no end. Marv Wolfman. Notice something he doesn't mention at all about the conception of the character. What's in that introduction. I don't recall him mentioning anything about needing to deal with his sexuality, because, again, that's not the point of the character.
It's not important in a Batman comic?
It definitely wasn't back then. But that's the thing. It's like that was never who Tim Drake... I mean, again, I want to say it's never who Tim Drake was, but as far as the words of the creators, it wasn't part of his character, and the character wasn't conceived to be that. The character was conceived to be, like, I'm the guy that wants to be Robin. I'm the kid that was smart enough that I figured out who Dick Grayson was and who Batman was on my own, and then I confronted them and said, hey, Batman needs a Robin. And he didn't want to be Batman. He wanted to be Robin.
Yeah.
And he's the best fucking Robin there ever was.
Yeah.
So there's that. So my last point is quotes from a podcast by Chuck Dixon, who was the writer who, even though he didn't create Tim Drake, he wrote numerous issues of the standalone Robin comic and worked on the character during most of his development. So Chuck Dixon is very well versed in Tim Drake Robin. And this is off of a podcast that he himself does If anybody wants to verify that I'm actually quoting correctly, we'll put the link for his podcast into the description. You can check it out for yourself, which I did. He said all this. So the website I looked at just had a couple of key points quoted in here. Dixon went on to discuss the retcon. He explained, quote, "Robin is an iconic character. He's been around forever. I'm not surprised by what happened because this is what they do. It's disappointing more than anything else." He continued, "Because why couldn't they just create a new character instead of leaning into a question that's existed for the Robin character almost since his creation thanks to this gentleman, Frederick Wortham, who introduced the idea that there may be some sort of homosexual subtext to Batman and Robin, and now they've basically confirmed."
Wait, what?
Okay, so in the 50s, there was a guy named Dr. Frederick Wortham. He wrote a book called The Seduction of the Innocent. And he basically, amongst other things, blamed comics for juvenile delinquency. So a lot of the things, as far as like the self-governing comics code authority, a lot of the titles that were like controversial at the time, he basically got all this stuff canceled and put a lot of restrictions on comics because he basically, you know, he's like, I'm a doctor. I know what I'm talking about. I'm a kid psychologist. I know what they're thinking. It's promoting juvenile delinquency by reading these comics. And he also apparently was the first one to bring up the idea of like, hey, you know what? This relationship between Bruce Wayne and Dick Grayson, it's, you know, maybe it means a little bit something else. Maybe it means whatever.
Jesus Christ.
That's where it all began. So I think like he's the reason that the old EC Comics, Tales from the Crypt, Vault of Horror, all that shit got canceled because what? He was the one who was like, no, it's promoting too much. It's ruining kids' minds. And then I think the Comics Code Authority, which is basically like their self-auditing, self-governing, you know, system. Like if they hadn't created the Comics Code Authority to like restrict themselves,
yeah,
then at that point somebody else would have. So he's kind of responsible for that too.
Oh my god.
But anyway, so what Chuck Dixon is basically saying, yes, is that by, yeah, doing this now, something that he started suggesting in the 50s,
yeah,
that wasn't true then, they're now basically like trying to solidify and be like, well, actually, yeah, it is.
Oh my god.
So Chuck Dixon goes on to say, quote, For what reason, I have no understanding. It's a cynical marketing ploy because it brings attention to the title.
Yeah.
What it will not bring to the title is increased sales because these things never work that way.
Mm-hmm.
There have been gay characters in American comics since the 80s. It's not a new thing. It's not stunning or brave. It's just changing things for the sake of changing them. I mean, what's next? Hal Jordan is a cannibal? What are they going to do next? Goes on to say, this has been the flavor of the month for almost three decades. Is to reveal that a character is bi or gay, which to me is a distinction without a difference. I don't understand the point of it. The character was never written that way, never conceived this way, but this is going to be his continuity from now on, even if they retcon it back, even if they do a reboot and he's no longer bi-curious, he will be bi-curious for the rest of time. This is going to be part of his continuity. I don't think there's any real good reason for this beyond a simple marketing ploy. Like I said, these marketing ploys, they don't work. They're not effective. They don't raise sales, but they raise interest from the media and from the peers within the industry, which I guess is the point, to get your back slapped at an editorial meeting or possibly to get on to get an interview with Vanity Fair. Maybe your name might be mentioned on CNN. But I think the vast majority of American public has no idea who Tim Drake is. So now Robin is gay because they don't know the difference between they don't know that there's been three versions of Robin or five or four or whatever. They just know Robin and the Boy Wonder. So they're thinking Burt Ward and Adam West, and now Robin is into guys. But at the end of the day, it's just lazy writing. It's like when they used to kill characters to get interest in them, and that was the only idea they had for a long time.
Hmm.
Now they delve into the character's sexual proclivities. So that was his point on that one. What does he say
here? And who's that guy?
Who was it?
Who was he? Yeah.
Chuck Dixon. He wrote like 100 issues of the Tim Drake Robin comic.
Oh, gotcha. Okay.
Yeah, I won't go. He goes into more stuff later on, but like the other thing. Yeah, he says, it's simply hinting at what might happen in between the panels or in between issues, so I don't see the point in it. No, I'm not disgusted. I'm not angry. I don't own these characters. They can do what they want with them. But it is just, it's boring at the end of the day. It's just boring and a little disappointing.
Mm-hmm.
So,
100%.
Yeah, I mean, that just, it goes back to that whole thing of, like, again, I keep in my head going back to the idea of, like, why couldn't you have done that to Damian Wayne? A character who doesn't have, like, 40 years, almost 40 years worth of, you know, pre-existing continuity. A character who's only been around for, like, maybe a decade or so, who actually, like, because of who the character is, you could say, like, hey, he had to repress these things. Hey, it's only starting to, like, you know, come to fruition. Plus, he's, like, younger, so it's, like, as he's growing up, it's, like, you know, developing more. Yeah, that's fine. Put it in there. Develop it. Make it a long-term thing. Stretch it out. Natural progression. This whole knee-jerk reaction of, like, hey, we're introducing a four-issue series where, well, hey, guess what? Did you know Tim Drake was bisexual? Well, neither did he, but now he is. And then you get your DC Pride issue, which is all about that thing. And now, I guess the focus of Megan Fitzmartin's Robin comic is mostly going to be about the relationship between him and Bernard, at least as far as what issue one number one is looking like.
So it's just fan fiction.
It's fan fiction, and it's lazy. It's like you said, it's lazy writing. Lazy. I like how he pointed out the thing of, like, it used to be that you would kill off a major character.
Yeah.
I mean, that's, like, the biggest selling comic book issue, I think, of all time to this day. Single issue of a comic.
Yeah.
Was Superman number 75. Okay. Which is the death of Superman.
Okay.
Which they marketed the shit out of that thing. Like, and it's so weird how, like, the impact of that goes away once you know, take it away.
Yeah.
Because obviously why people thought he was permanently dead, I have no idea. But the fact that Superman died was a media blitz. That was in everything.
What year was that?
1993?
Okay.
93 or 94, I think. And I think the only reason that even came about was because in the comics, Superman and Lois Lane, like, she knew who he was at this point. He proposed, they were going to get married. And around the same time that they were going to have him get married in the comics, there was the TV show Lois and Clark, The New Adventures of Superman. And they were slowly developing their relationship on that show, and they wanted them to get married on the TV show. And they didn't want... I think it was something where, like, they didn't want the character to get married in the comics before it happened on the TV show. And I remember, I saw it on, like, a documentary once, that they had, like, the round table, you know, the writer's room where they worked out the stories for, like, the next year, and it all revolved around the planning of the wedding between Lois and Clark and the eventual marriage and stuff that happened with him as Superman and blah, blah, blah. And then all of a sudden they were told, you can't do any of that. We need to postpone the wedding until the show is ready to do it. And they were like, well, fucking hell. Well, what do we do now? We got to throw out an entire year's worth of stories. What are we going to do? And then the one guy who every writer's meeting, when they were having writer's block, he would always jokingly be like, let's just kill him. And this time he said, let's just kill him. And instead of people being like, ha, they're like, oh. So all of a sudden, a year's worth of storyline became the death, the funeral, and then the eventual return of Superman. But yeah, that issue sold like gangbusters. And, like, I don't think sales of Superman as a comic were ever, before or since, as high as they were during that run. So it's like, yeah, you know, you do that, and then you get sales, you get media coverage. I mean, the fucking death of Superman was on the cover of Newsweek.
Yeah.
Newsweek!
Really?
Yes. They did a commemorative issue about Superman. It's insane.
It gets the headlines.
It gets the headlines. Then I mean, it was the year after that is when they didn't kill Batman, but that was where they introduced Bane, created by, lo and behold, Chuck Dixon. And Bane broke Batman's back.
Yeah.
So all of a sudden, Bruce Wayne is confined to a wheelchair, and you had to have a new Batman take over for like a year until they resolved that.
Who's the new Batman?
Azrael. Jean-Paul Valley. Azrael. That's a whole other...
Anyways.
That's a whole other conversation. Anyways. But that was... He's right. That was the trend, because they killed Superman. They broke Batman's back. And probably the most extreme one that I can think of is when they took the existing Green Lantern, Hal Jordan, and they literally had him go insane it was right after the return of Superman. There was some... Like, during the battle with Superman and the return and everything, Coast City, where Hal Jordan was from, got destroyed. Like, literally destroyed. And he gets so freaked out about it that he tries to rebuild his city with the power of the Green Lantern ring.
Oops.
But he doesn't have enough power with the ring to make it stay. So he loses his fucking mind, and he goes around and starts murdering all the other Green Lanterns and stealing their rings and using all of their rings to rebuild the city. And then he just like gets consumed with power and he becomes a villain called Parallax that all of a sudden the rest of the DC universe has to like team together to destroy.
Yeah.
And then they kill Hal Jordan and then they bring in Kyle Rayner as like the new Green Lantern. So again, it was either one or the other or a combination in this case. You either kill the character, Superman, you get rid of the character and replace him with somebody else, Batman, or you do both. You kill him and replace him with somebody else, Green Lantern. Yeah. That was like the trend. Yeah, but now apparently the trend is, oh, well, let's explore their sexuality, let's change something else, we'll make headlines, right. That's the hot button topic, let's do it. But there's no thought process into it. Like, not like I never bring up Star Wars before, but like enough, it seems like enough thought went into the development of Tim Drake being a gay or bisexual character as thought was put into the Star Wars sequel trilogy. It's like, we need to do this. I don't care how you do it. Just make it happen now because it needs to happen now.
Mm-hmm.
And it's lazy. And, you know, in my opinion, it's pandering.
Yeah.
And I hate saying that. Because, again, as soon as you bring up that opinion, the standard response from general public is like, well, no, you just don't like him because he's gay. I'm like, I don't give a shit if you make him gay.
Yeah,
I don't care. Exactly. I literally don't care. Like I said, Damian Wayne, make him gay, make Tim Drake. I don't care. But have it make sense. Have it be in, like, good writing. Have it be in, like, a good, compelling story. And don't lose track of who the character is as far as the importance of the book. It's not about Tim Drake and his personal journey of self-discovery. It's about Tim Drake being Robin.
Yeah.
Tim Drake is Robin, and he's been the best Robin for decades now. I don't need the focus of his book to suddenly be about whether or not he's dating a guy. Like, his personal life was always a background to his existing book, but it was always, first and foremost, him being Robin. And that's where most of the conflict came from, is like, how does he juggle life, you know, parents not knowing what he's doing, being in school, having a girlfriend, having friends, and then still being Robin? How does he work that out?
Yeah.
And now it seems more like, oh, we're going to delve into Tim Drake's journey of self-discovery and, you know, how he's now this and that and that. Oh, by the way, he's also Robin. Every now and then he's going to go out and fight crime. But when he's fighting crime, he's going to be thinking about when he's going to go on a date with Bernard again. Because as I quote from the first issue of that series, it's been 6 months and I'm still pinching myself. Okay. Sure. I mean, again, it comes out of nowhere.
Yeah.
It's never been a thing before. And again, like the way that they've been drawing him and writing him in the comic,
it just sounds bad.
Well, even the like bad. Marv Wolfman was talking about in that introduction how DC wanted them to de-age Dick Grayson back down to being like 15, 16. And they were like, no, we already aged him up to like 18 and we wanted to make him more mature. Literally, they've never said it as far as I can tell, but the way they're drawing him and writing him, it's like they de-aged Tim Drake back down to being like 14 or 15 again. He looks significantly younger and he acts like a little kid.
Yeah.
Like he acts like an immature teenager who just happens to also be Robin. But like Tim Drake has, even in comic continuity, is like older now. He's got to be at least in like his 20s, but that doesn't work for what they're doing, I guess. I don't know.
Right.
I ranted about that long enough. I don't know. It's the thing. And it's like, you can't talk about that for fear of getting backlash from people thinking that you're like closed-minded. And it's like, it's got nothing to do with that.
Which is not what we're saying. Exactly, yeah.
And, you know, and I've seen comments from people that have talked about it. I've literally watched, like, a YouTube video where, like, a guy was complaining about it and saying what horrible writing it was and what a terrible, like, arc it is. And I didn't even know until he said it, like, halfway through the video, oh, he's gay. And he even said he was talking about that DC Pride issue where, you know, Tim's former girlfriend got introduced to Bernard. I was like, oh, best day ever, that part. And he's like, yeah, as a guy who, you know, I'm very much, you know, openly gay now, and I wasn't for a long time, and speaking as a guy who did date a girl for a long time, and then had to sort of like come out to the closet and be like, actually, I'm gay, and then introduce her to like the guy I'm dating, I can tell you right now, that is not how she reacted first time meeting my new boyfriend. It was much more awkward than that. So
like, that wasn't her response?
Exactly. So it's like, yeah, I mean, I'm sure my opinion would be treated in an interesting way because of the fact that I am like a straight white male, and it's going to seem like I'm just complaining, but it's like I'm not complaining about the decision. I'm complaining about the execution of it. It's the way that they're handling it, and it's the reasoning for the way they're handling it. It's not, they're not doing it because like an innovative writer who's taken over Robin and has been writing the character for years is suddenly like, hey, you know what? I've been laying the groundwork for a while. This is where I want to take the character. I feel like it's a good progression, whatever. No, you literally brought a new writer on, not even to like develop it. You brought the writer on to do this.
Right.
To make headlines.
Yeah.
And that, to me, is pandering.
Of course it is. Yeah.
It's the other thing of like, you know, yeah, you want to bring diversity, you want to bring inclusion, you want to bring all that, but like when you're specifically doing it to make headlines for yourself, how is that good? Like, if you just worked it into existing books, you just worked it into existing books and existing writing and didn't make a big fucking deal out of it, that to me would be better.
Yeah.
It's like the weirdest thing I can, as an analogy I can think of, I think we talked about before, was that interview that I saw on YouTube where somebody was talking to Morgan Freeman and they asked him about Black History Month.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, are you going to do anything special? Are you celebrating Black History Month? And he's like, no. And he's like, I don't celebrate Black History Month. And they're like, why? He's like, because it's not Black history. It's American history.
Yeah.
Why are we having to specify it? And he's like, and why 1 month?
Yeah.
Why is it relegated to 1 month? And it's not just our history, it's American history. And, you know, he's got a point. It's like,
yeah,
why are we taking, like, specific demographics and we're like, hey, you know what? You get a month.
Right.
You get a month, and 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 this is your day. And this is like, if we're going to be truly, like, progressive and we're going to be truly inclusive, then it's just like, then just have it all the time. Like, don't make a headline out of the fact, like, guess what? This character is gay. Like, why is that headline worthy then?
Yeah.
If it's so inclusive, why is that a thing that needs to be a headline? And in all this, and yeah, I don't know.
It's controversial. It gets people talking about it.
Like us right now.
I've never read these comic books, but I know a lot about them now.
Yes. Yeah. You probably know more than you ever thought you would. And that's
it's
the thing.
Because,
like,
it's because they're doing this.
Yeah.
And like, it's like that guy said, it's the flavor of the month, you know. Next year or next month, it's going to be something different.
And the only difference now is that, like we said, because they're establishing it both in other forms of media, whether it's the Gotham Knights game, whether it's the Titan show, now that it's out there and they're putting it in other media, it's like, well, one way or the other, it's sticking.
Yeah, it doesn't matter. Seems like they're doubling down.
Yeah.
They
and even like circling back to that article is like, even that, to me, you want to read between the lines? I'm going to read between the lines of that. Reading between the lines of that says, oh, we're getting not the overall fan reaction we were hoping for, and we're getting criticism that this is coming out of nowhere.
Right.
So, dude, you need to do damage control. You need to go back through all the issues where these characters appeared, and you need to, quote-unquote, read between the lines and say, well, you know, in issue number, they said this. And I mean, I'm not one to talk. I'm one of those people that, as you know, will like interpret stuff and like deep dive into things and be like, well, maybe this, maybe that.
But this is so disingenuous. It's not, everybody knows that's fake.
Well, that's the other thing. It's like when I do it, I'm doing it for like headcanon. I'm like, hey, I'll justify a bad decision in a movie because I think this.
Right.
But I'm not saying that that's for sure what it is. That's just me to make myself feel better.
Or you're coming up with theories and you go back through different books or whatever.
Yeah.
But
this is literally them being like, oh, well, if you read between the lines, well, based on what we know now, it shows this in a whole new light. And be like, yeah, but no. Because even the people that wrote the stuff said, no, that's not what we meant.
Case closed.
Done.
The end.
It's like, stop looking for shit that's not there.
But it's damage control.
Yes.
That's the perfect word for it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Ugh. I feel like the, if there's any of our podcasts that's actually going to get any kind of like response or reaction, it may be this one.
Or maybe not.
Or maybe not. Maybe or nobody maybe will not. Listen to a goddamn thing we say. There's always that.
It's always that.
But yeah, that was my rant for the day. So cool.
Well, needed to be said.
I needed to get it off my chest because, I've kind of just like let it roll because I'm not fully reading, comics as much as I used to when I was a kid just because I can't afford it anymore. And most of the time it's like there's just so much.
Yeah.
And like being an adult, there's so much shit you got to worry about when you're an adult, and it's like trying to keep up. Like even like the perfect example is that my ongoing reading of comics that I had when I was a kid has now completely probably transitioned into, the movies and the TV shows that are based on my comics. That's the equivalent now, is like, I don't have the time or the money to buy up all these comics and read everything that's going on, but you know what? I can go watch a movie.
Yeah.
And I can watch the Disney Plus shows and be like, hey, what's been going on? What happened in Avengers 1, 2, and 3?
Yeah.
That's what, right. It's evolved into that.
Uh-huh.
So I'm not as invested in the characters as I had been before because I don't know what the hell's going on anymore.
Yeah.
I literally have no clue. But again, it just seems, it's like you said, it's disingenuous to the character. It's like, it's not bad to make that decision for the character, but you owe it to the character and for the years of continuity of what people have been reading and the fandom that there is to the character to, at least if you're going to do that, do it in a smart way and do it in a creative way. Don't do it in a shoehorn way that's pandering to your audience. Like, I guarantee you, this Megan Fitzmarpin and all these people that are writing these comics, like, they guaranteed don't know shit about Tim Drake. Like, at all. It's just like DC gave them, like, hey, you're going to make the Robin gay. And she was probably like, cool, which one? Or maybe not. Maybe she doesn't even know there was more than one. And they were like, you're going to make the Tim Drake Robin gay. And she's like, all right. And literally probably like had a her knowledge of previous Tim Drake information probably came from less than what I just read to you. And that's it. So yeah. I don't know. I could keep going on and on, but it's going to get me in trouble.
Well,
we said general discussion. That's what it is.
That's a discussion.
Yeah.
You said what was on your mind?
I did. You said a couple things here and there.
I chimed in with a, yeah. Explain that again.
Here's what we're going to do. Next time, when you want to go on vacation, just allow me into your house to use your equipment. Yeah. And then beforehand, I want you to get on here and I want you to create a sound file of you going, huh. Yeah. Okay. Right. Yes. And then I will literally just like record myself on here, and every now and then I'll just like go into the existing file and I'll bloop in that. It'll be like you were here the whole time.
Really?
Yes. Huh. Oh, yes. Mm, good.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And then I'll just throw in like one random one where I'll say something like really serious and very deep and be like, oh. And what about that scene with the Holocaust? And then you'll be like, you're going like, oh, well.
Ah, yeah.
That happened.
We need to make a soundboard of all my responses.
Nathanisms.
Huh. Well.
Okay. Oh, come on. It'll be fine. Fuck it, we'll do it live.
I need to be a... Well, I won't say anything. I'm not giving anybody any ideas.
Wait, what?
Nothing.
What?
Nothing.
What?
Nothing.
Huh?
What?
Hmm?
Cutting that out.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know. I don't know. What did you have to talk about in this general discussion?
I chimed in with what I had.
Oh, okay.
Huh.
Well, I mean, anything other than that topic, any other general discussion stuff, anything you've been wanting to get off of your chest other than your hatred of me for my dislike of year one?
No, I didn't really have much to... I never really have much. I just...
Nah.
I'm more, I listen, and I...
You're a good listener.
I'm the audience.
You are literally the audience. There's not that many others out there.
The one-man live audience.
The one-man live audience. Yeah. See, that's the thing. Is like, I just need someone to play off of.
Yeah. Yes.
I guess.
Apparently. And I like it. And I like, and I know. I fill that role.
See, here's the thing. What we'll need to do is expand. Once we get everything more well established, and we get our groove going, it's not just going to be, what do you mean you haven't seen?
Right.
It'll be, we discussed about it before, it'll be, what do you mean you've never read?
Right.
Or what do you mean you've never seen this TV show? Or what do you mean, or you can then, to me, be like, what do you mean you've never listened to this band?
Yeah, or we could have a whole podcast on it. Like, what do you mean you didn't like year one?
Just, we'll do it on the anniversary. We'll be like, what do you mean you didn't like year one? Oh, shit.
Every year I'm going to bring this up.
The annual, the anniversary podcast episode, you'd be like, yeah, can't believe you fucking didn't like year one. You son of a bitch. The one thing that I picked, and then you're like, you.
Well, I can always tell when you don't like movies. Why? Well, I mean, in year one, it was pretty obvious you were trashing it the entire fucking time.
Well, what's the other way?
What? You want me to say it?
Yeah.
I didn't think you like... We watched The Lighthouse.
Okay.
Robert Eggers.
Uh-huh.
I don't think you liked it.
Why?
You talked.
I talked.
Through the movie.
Did I?
Yeah. You would talk, you would interrupt, and you would bring up stuff and be like, what? No, you gotta watch. I was like, me of all people, I was like, Bob, we gotta watch what's going on here.
We swap places.
I'm getting annoyed. It's like, the next I was waiting for you to like fucking start nodding out.
I do need to watch that movie again.
Usually Bob is like, come on, we gotta, okay, yeah. But really, we gotta watch what's going on here, because this is really important.
Well, it's because I'm a hypocrite.
But all through The Lighthouse, you're like... But that's how I can tell. There really hasn't been any other movie.
The Lighthouse, I think, is something I need to see again, because I think, especially because you didn't tell me anything about it. The only thing I knew about it was like who was in it and the farting. I'm like, it's a movie with Robert Pattinson, Willem Dafoe, and Willem Dafoe farts. Yeah. And that's about all I knew.
But there's really, because if I said anything, it would, like, give away.
I know, two guys going insane. And I get it. I understand that. Yeah. But, like, even when it gets, like, to the really weird shit, I was just like, what the fuck? So it's almost like one of those movies where, like, now that I know what I'm in for, it'll probably play differently when I watch it again, just because of that, you know, pre-existing knowledge, where it's like, well, I'll give you a very, very, very good example.
Yeah.
A very good example. You know, obviously now, after watching Twin Peaks, you've kind of developed into a David Lynch. Well, now you've watched more than one David Lynch thing, because we watched Twin Peaks, but you also watched Blue Velvet with me.
Hey, I'm always open to watching more.
Mm-hmm. So, another one of the very Twin Peaks-ish movies that David Lynch did, 2001, he did Mulholland Drive.
I want to see that.
Yeah. Now, that movie, I saw that in theaters when it came out, because I was in college at the time, and, you know, film major and everything else, and my roommate at the time, he was much more like, I hadn't seen Twin Peaks at that point.
Yeah.
I don't think I'd seen any David Lynch except for Dune and The Elephant Man. So I didn't have any preconceived notions about David Lynch and his type of movie and his, you know, leaving everything up to interpretation, you know, not spelled out for you kind of shit.
Yep.
And I went to go see Mulholland Drive with my roommate, and he was very gung-ho about it. And, you know, I sat through that movie, and by the time that movie was, like, close to being over, there was nobody in that theater except for, like, me, him, and, like, one other person. And I remember, like, towards the end of it, and I'm not exaggerating, I was literally, like, leaning forward in my chair, banging my head against the chair in front of me, because I was like, what the fuck is going on? What is this?
Yeah.
What is this? And, like, I remember hating it. Because I'm like, I don't know. What is any of this? What? Like, I had no fucking clue. No clue whatsoever. I did somehow, for whatever reason, buy it on DVD when it came out, though. So I don't know. I don't know if it was just like, wait, I was...
Even at the end, you had no idea what's going on?
No clue at all.
I want to watch this.
Yeah. There's no direct interpretation of it. The one thing that I that I did, and I think even David Lynch, maybe he was forced by the studio because it was put out by Universal.
Yeah.
When the DVD came out, there was an insert, which I kept from my DVD copy. I kept it with my Criterion Blu-ray. It's like a little insert that came with the DVD where it was like 5 hints from David Lynch to figure out the movie.
Oh, my God.
And it literally has like, pay attention to the opening credits. Okay. Think about this thing. Who has it, and then where does it disappear to? In this scene, dialogue in the background, what are the people talking about? And some shit like that.
This is...
And I remember watching the movie again with those hints, and then I was like, oh. And then, like, I liked it so much better the next time around.
Yeah.
Because, again, I knew what I was in for. I knew, I'm like, okay, this thing's going to be fucking weird, and it's not going to make a whole lot of sense. But, like, all right, I got some hints and whatnot. I'm going to go deep dive in, whatever. It probably didn't help that it was in theater. So, like, it's constantly going. It's not like I can, like, stop.
Right, right.
But, yeah, it was a weird fucking movie. And it's still a weird fucking movie. But I was just like, it probably doesn't help. I found out after the fact that Mulholland Drive started off as a pilot episode, a pilot movie for another David Lynch TV series that he proposed to do for ABC. And then, like, he shot it, he showed it to the network, and the network was like, no, we're not taking this. So he bought it back from them and then went back and reshot additional material. And, you know, because basically what he was doing is setting up subplots for subsequent episodes that are now never going to be resolved. So he went back, shot new footage, shot different stuff, and basically restructured the whole thing as a standalone movie.
Yeah.
So I think a lot of the stuff that I might have been like, what the fuck does this have to do with anything else? Is sort of like, oh, maybe these were the subplots for the proposed TV show that never happened.
Yeah.
But I don't know. It plays a lot better. I feel like The Lighthouse might be the same thing where it's like, you know, once you know what you're in for, going into it, it'll play better. Because that's the thing, as I get older, I find out about this is like, movies, your interpretation of them and how your opinion of them changes as you get older. Yeah. We talked about it before with Wizard of Oz. Like, when you're a kid, you totally believe she went to Oz. You don't believe that it's a dream at all.
Right.
But then, like, when you're an adult, you're like, oh, no, we're pretty sure she just, like, got knocked unconscious and had a nightmare.
Yeah.
Or Miracle on 34th Street. You don't pick up on the stuff as a kid where they blatantly tell you, no, he's not Santa Claus. He lives in, like, an old folks' home.
Yeah.
But, like, when you're a kid, you don't pay attention to that. You're like, he's Santa Claus. It's done. Right. I remember when I was a kid, 1995, 96, when Mortal Kombat, the movie, came out.
Oh.
I fucking loved that movie. I loved the shit out of that movie. And then I watched it again a couple of years ago. I'm like, oh, man, this movie's bad.
Yeah.
This movie's really bad. Hackers. Oh, man. Oh, man. I grew up watching that. My wife grew up watching that. I bought it on Blu-ray when it came out a couple of years ago. We sat down. We watched it again for the first time in probably like over a decade. And we were like, whew, this is not aged well.
Charlie Brown. Yeah. I watched it on Thanksgiving. I watched the Thanksgiving special.
Did you? Oh, yeah.
I tuned out after like 5 minutes. I was like, oh, this is bad.
Yeah, I mean, it's the thing is, like, movies will change, and I know I've told you about it before. Like, the first time I watched Trainspotting, I hated it.
Really?
Because
too much heroin.
I felt dirty watching it. Feel like dirty. I just felt like icky the whole time. And I'm like, I don't like this. I don't like the way this movie makes me feel.
Nope.
And then I watched it again.
Yeah.
But watching it more like from the perspective of who the characters are.
Yeah.
And all of a sudden, like, I liked it so much better. Now it's one of my favorite movies. I wouldn't have thought that at the time.
Talk about Trainspotting 2.
Yes.
Oh my God.
That deserves a rewatch. If we're gonna gear up
of
Well, especially we should do that, and we should use that as a gear up to shooting Twinkie Spotting 2 this summer.
Twinkie Spotting.
Which that's another story. What's okay? It's another story for another day. But
never mind.
Yeah, yeah. See, that's another thing. Like, it seems like that movie, Trainspotting 2, T2 Trainspotting, whatever they wanted to call it, I feel like it didn't get enough, like, it seems like not as many people liked it as I thought would, and now it's just like, people are like, whatever, no one cares.
It I love that movie.
But it's so good.
I want to watch it again.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And, I mean, again, it probably has a lot to do with, like, the age I'm at now and the fact that it, like, hey, you know, I saw that original movie, you know, it came out in 1996. I probably saw it a couple years after that, right about the time that I was going off to college. So I'm not too far removed from the age of the characters in the movie.
Right.
And then, you know, the second one comes out and it's 20 years later and, you know, hey, I'm 20 years older and watching a movie with the same actors playing the same characters 20 years later and seeing how both the characters and the actors have developed, and it's like, oh, think how much I've changed in 20 years. Right. It's just so weird.
Yeah.
It's really good. I like it.
It does deserve its own episode of So Nice.
Well, no, we can't use it for that one because that's for remakes.
Oh, right. Yeah. Never mind. Fuck.
Sequel Saturdays.
I'm cutting that out.
Yeah. Cutting it out. Cutting it out. Pew, pew, pew. Yeah, no, that'll be a good one.
Oh, what was the other one? Sequel what?
Sequel Saturdays.
That's the one. Oh, we're already making plans.
Good times.
Maybe, hopefully, we'll follow up on.
Maybe. We'll see. We'll see.
Fall through on.
Yeah. I don't know.
Well, I'll tell you what.
Yeah.
I don't know. I was hoping I'd think of something.
At outros. Absolutely terrible at outros is the one thing. It's like we can come up with some clever way to start an episode. We can come up with like a little sketch, some little riff thing. We suck at the outros.
I was really hoping something would come to me.
Yeah, and it didn't.
So I was just like, I'll tell you what. And I was like, oh, come on.
And the best part is like you're stretching like,
I'm just buying time.
Nobody can see that. So it just sounds like you're like, I'll tell you what. And then dead silence. Yeah. If we just cut it off there, like literally, like, hey, I'll tell you what.
That's not a bad way to end.
The file just ends.
That's not a bad way to end.
We just need a jingle. Yeah. We need some kind of outro jingle that we can just put in so we can be like, hey, remember to like, subscribe, and follow us on whatever the fuck. And then,
Well, we do have an Instagram.
Yeah, there we go.
Hey, we have some social media.
And here's the outro music.
Well,
keep going. Go for it.
Yeah, we have social media. You know, maybe I should link them in the description because it's what other people do. Don't really post that much to it, but probably should.
Wrap it up.
It's going to be on YouTube. My name is Nathan.
I'm Bob.
Hey.
Let's get the hell out of here.
That's it.
Bye.